You're listening to the Jaipur Rugs podcast.
Hello, I'm Cosmo Brockway, and on the occasion of the 2024 edition of the Jaipur Lit Fest, you're listening to a specially commissioned podcast by Jaipur Rugs. In this edition, I'm reading from various passages from issues of The World of Interiors, the magazine where I'm a contributing editor based between Delhi and London. So we begin with Balera Palace, which is just outside of Lucknow, the ancestral home of the Mahmudabad family who inherited it from a maternal line. This was my first ever commission from World of Interiors by Rupert Thomas, the then editor-in-chief. And I also love it because this is a palace that means a lot to me personally. It's somewhere that I was entranced by on my first sighting of it. It's the most intact 18th century palace in Uttar Pradesh. And it was a privilege to be welcomed here by the Raja Sahib and to be given access to write this very unique story. The North Indian state of Uttar Pradesh is one of the last bastions of feudal life left on the whole of the subcontinent. The centuries melt away here to a gentler, more poetic age. Villagers and princes alike still speak of the 1857 sepoy mutiny as though it was a recent happening, and ancestors' exploits are recounted with detailed gusto. The old kingdom of Awadh was a place of high Urdu culture and the heartland of Sufism, a mystical branch of Islam. Shards of the courtly rituals survive behind peeling facades emblazoned with scaled fish, the symbol of the region. A mango grove-lined drive from the state capital Lucknow leads to the long-jilted palace of Balera. The building is one of India's most striking examples of Indo-European Regency architecture, whose simple lines preceded the more belligerent Indo-Gothic style. It has lain more or less untouched since the demise of the last Raja of Balera, Abdul Hasan Khan, in the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918. The flu also claimed the life of his 8-year-old heir only a few months previously. Family lore has the father actually dying of a broken heart. Three young daughters were left as the sole heiresses to one of the older Shia dynasties in the country. The British circled, ready to assume control of the estate as the ward of court, before a plot was hatched to see them off. The elder daughter, Kanizabid, became Rani of Balera in her own right. Through marriage with her cousin, she shored up the family line by uniting it with the powerful neighboring Rajas of Mahmudabad, while also cleverly halting any British claim to Balera. The present custodian is her only son, the 77-year-old Raja Muhammad Amir Muhammad Khan, who sadly passed away last year. He movingly described the first seeing of his maternal inheritance as we wandered through the palace together. "I did not step through the gates until 1973, age 29, despite growing up just an hour away," he says. "My mother, perhaps due to superstition and long-held remorse over her family's misfortune, had never wanted me to visit the place. But as I stood in the shadowy Darbar Hall with his extraordinary jail durry stretching into the distance, I was overcome with a sense of returning home." At that time, the main rooms of the palace had not been used since the flu scourge of 1918. The redoubtable Rani would stay in the Zanana, or women's quarters, on her annual visits, a chalky warren of austere chambers with muslin drapes fluttering across the doors into courtyards worn smooth by generations of purdah, a place of honor and storytelling. The Zanana still holds the untouched bedroom of the late Rani, who would travel from her married home to Balera in a palanquin, even in the 1960s, held aloft by four men and a mounted guard. "As the party reached her realm, my mother's palanquin would be laid on the side of the road," remembered the Raja. "She would lift the embroidered curtain to gaze across the orchard and rivers with tearful pride and longing." An able administrator behind the veil, the Rani is remembered for her prodigious knowledge of the local families and her benevolence and piety, steering the estate through the choppy waters of independence and Mrs. Gandhi's purges of royal purses. Her husband, who advised Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan, left for a nomadic life in Iraq, Pakistan, and finally London. The Rani, however, remained defiantly Indian to the end of her days, before being reunited in burial with her husband at the shrine of Imam Reza in Iran, a place of frequent family pilgrimage. Built by two Rajas of Balera, father and son, between 1835 and 1865, the palace has the solid swagger of a plantation house. The family were awarded the estate, then a mostly barren stretch of bandit country in the mid-14th century, and lived in a mud fort until constructing the palace in Lahori bricks and mortar. Its simplicity feels more akin to the merchant villas of Calcutta than the decadent palazzos of Lucknow. Arab warriors in origin and descended from the first caliph of Islam, the family first entered India as emissaries to the Qazi of Baghdad in about 1205, and settling in Awadh, served under the Mughals with great valor. The Balera line was in fact the senior branch of the Mahmudabad clan, but enjoyed far less pomp. They were content to husband their estate and keep in with the overseeing British, while secretly funding mutinous forays against them in 1857, before the two lines swam back into unison with the marriage of Rani Kanizabid and her Mahmudabad cousin in 1929. The palace's whitewashed portico, complete with gongs and string beds, whets the eye with its seemingly half-finished grandeur. A triple bay of doors, two with delicate fanlights, leads into a dust-brocaded hall lined with Victorian parlour chairs and painted photographs of cherubic young princes. All has been still since 1918. Blissfully cool in the searing North Indian heat, the rooms unfurl in a panoply of vivid colours, protected against the ravages of light by long window shutters. Burnt ochre yellow bedrooms, square and high, dance with turquoise stenciling, almost as fresh as when they were first painted by artisans on bamboo ladders in the 1840s. The double-height Durbar Hall, once alive with ceremony, is brought down to earth by a pair of Romanesque-inspired fireplaces and those extraordinary durries commissioned by the then Raja. The royal builders of India loved to mingle European domestic elements such as these with the grandest of native vernacular in a singular approach to scale and form that both delights and frustrates purists. Similarly, perhaps influenced by the tastes of their British tutors and governesses, they would quite often eschew more traditional furniture makers of the day for the bourgeois replicas of cosy whatnots and love seats made in the former capital, Calcutta. Arches, typical of the Awadhi school of architecture, lead the eye, blinking in the half light, to long dining rooms that are festooned with shrouded chandeliers and tumbling piles of chipped royal Worcester soup tureens and plates. Such is India that on my visit, within an hour, the vastly sheeted table, barely used in a century, was groaning with an indulgent lunch. I counted 12 dishes, all conjured up by one resident retainer couple. As we ate Iranian pulao and smoked beetroot and cumin yogurt, the Raja spoke of the many evenings of Qawwali that he would hold cross-legged on the durries with guests before plates of rosewater sweetmeats were shared. The family still gathers yearly at Balera to commemorate the Shiite festival of Muharram. Such is the respect that they are held in, both as landowners and spiritual leaders, there is little need for security. The clanging iron gates are kept open so that the local men can play football in the shaded grounds and offer namaz prayer at the baubled imambara or shrine at the foot of the palace. And so the Raja has now died since this was written, so I just want to say the gentle Raja, who was a noted writer and scholar and divided his time between the family house in Lucknow and the splendid Mahmudabad fort, appears occasionally to walk among the dried up fountains and avenues of wax-leaved magnolia trees. His eyes glisten as he talks about how his two sons are planning to restore the palace and turn it into a Dasha-type retreat for visiting writers and artists. As we turn away, with his quavering voice now vanishing into the breeze, he pauses to reflect. "My father's fort, Mahmudabad, is my duty," he says, "but Balera is my heart." Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, where we delve further into the world of craftsmanship, I wish you all well.
You're listening to the Jaipur Rugs Podcast.
Hello, I'm Cosmo Brockway, and on the occasion of the 2024 edition of the Jaipur Lit Fest, you're listening to a specially commissioned podcast by Jaipur Rugs. In this edition, I'm reading from various passages from issues of The World of Interiors, the magazine where I'm a contributing editor based between Delhi and London. While I was overjoyed when Rupert Thomas, the editor of World of Interiors at the time, commissioned me to write about the Mahmudabad Fort outside Lucknow, because it was the house that I had long dreamed of conjuring up through my own words, it remains one of the most memorable shoots I've ever done for two reasons, neither of which particularly positive, but they do stay in my mind. One was that it coincided with an enormous Bollywood shoot that was taking place at the palace at the same time as myself and photographer who's visiting from London, James McDonald, went there to stay. And we walked in to be surrounded. Well, the first hint of the shoot was the garish green shutters that had been repainted to evoke the atmosphere of this horror film that was being shot. But I spent the next 2 days in a tussle, tug of war with the director of the film, because every time he would move props into, say, the Durbar Hall, I would come along and move them out for the shoot, then walk back to find them they'd been promptly put back again. By the end of it, my tenacity was such that the crew were actually listening to me more than him. So I did end up getting my way. The other memorable feature of that astonishing visit, that it was the last shoot that we did before COVID lockdown was announced. And I remember getting on the plane from Lucknow, and it was the first time I'd ever put a mask on my face. I found the Raja Saab, who has since sadly passed away, to be one of the most eloquent men that I've ever interviewed, which I actually had to do remotely from London because of the pandemic. And as he has since passed away, I think the recording of that interview is one of my most treasured possessions. So I'd just like to walk you through this extraordinary place that I hope all of you will visit whenever you find yourself in the storied city of Lucknow. There is soil from Karbala and thrones from Qatar in this palace, says Ali Khan Mahmoodabad, as we stand under the fish-scaled entrance gate and survey the stately fort that is recent inheritance. An hour's drive from Lucknow in northern India, Mahmoodabad Palace has had a tumultuous history that belies its present peace. It has been the scene of battles, face being cannonballed by the British, and was even sealed up with wax. But today, thanks in part to the work of its new Raja, an author and professor, its future is steady. Khan was, as per family tradition, sent away to be educated at Winchester College, but always knew his destiny lay in this corner of the state of Abad. It's a region rich in courtly manners and legend, where the old customs are still venerated. The Qila, or palace, bolsters this sense of identity. Its sturdy walls and towers a living museum to a feudal ritualistic way of life that for many is still a reality. The Khan clan first settled among these mango orchards in the 16th century under the patronage of Emperor Akbar the Great, who was impressed by their tremendous courage in battle. Khan's father, the late Raja Saab of Mahmoodabad, came to the Qila in 1974. After a tumultuous upbringing and years spent at an ancestral home in Karbala, Iraq, where generations of the family had been buried, sacred soil was brought there to lie under the Mahmoodabad shrines built in the 19th century as replicas of those near the banks of the Euphrates. Raja Saab spoke of childhood visits to the Qila while it was sealed up by the government due to his father's involvement with Pakistan. The royal family would sleep on the verandas surrounded by the scent of night-flowering jasmine. Total exile could not be born. When it was reopened in 1966, they discovered the extent of the looting. Even the Rani's trousseau had been burnt in an attempt to extract the gold and silver thread. The pillar of the Qila's calendar is Mukarram, the Shia festival of mourning for the martyr Imam Hussein. The family would travel there to lead the processions which still take place. Amir, the Raja's London-based youngest son, recalls, "I was a schoolboy from Winchester and wondered whose palace this was. It was never openly said to my brother and me that it was ours. Its ramparts and colonnades seemed fantastical. We used to hide and pretend to be jinns to scare the guards. In fact, the locals believe that our family are part jinn, so it wasn't too far-fetched. The family, standing as leaders of the Shiite community, being descendants of the first caliph of Islam, has long coloured life at the Qila. It may have been a mud fort. It was rebuilt in the Grand Victorian style after being shelled by the British quelling of the 1857 War of Independence. But the five imambaras, or shrines, woven into the building have always been a decorative marvel. The largest is draped with a panoramic embroidered kiswa from Mecca, a gift from the King of Saudi Arabia in 1951, while a smaller shrine holds a collection of European gilt mirrors. In yet another, generations of Ranis gave birth to heirs surrounded by relics. A fourth shrine, dedicated to the Prophet's daughter Fatima, has never felt a male footstep. Even a pregnant woman cannot enter in case she's carrying a boy. Each year, the men of the family lead wailing mourners and pilgrims from across the globe, such as the continued piety and passion. Time stands still in the shared grief for the Battle of Karbala in the 7th century. Every room has a ceremonial purpose. Even the dining rooms were only used for show. Food was important to the family. Legend has one Rani dispatching favourite desserts on she camels to wherever her royal son was stationed, while the palace kitchen sent Nehru one of its famous biryanis in a parcel with a bottle of champagne secreted inside while he was in a British jail. The court would gather on the veranda overlooking the gardens where immaculate white cotton sheets over dhurries were freshly laid each day. Courses were brought on octagonal trays covered in embers and sealed against poisoning by the steward. Such rituals pervaded even the simplest elements of life. The Grand Mukim Manzil in the men's part was once the scene of enthronements and audiences. Today it mostly stands silent, more likely to host a Bollywood film shoot or candlelit Sufi musical evenings for visiting groups. In the grand zinc-lined audience chamber, its demise monitored by the Hanoverian eyes of royal portraits, what remains of a vast knotted carpet is gradually being eaten away. But where other family houses have decayed, including nearby Balera Palace, the Qila is a survivor. Its magic lies in its strangeness. Who can forget walking down a shadowy velvet-lined corridor into a zinc-walled drawing room hung with full-length portraits of Queen Victoria and her heir? Of course, no one knows where they came from. The Raja hazards Calcutta, because all good things come from there. But the origin is immaterial, just as with the stories that bring each optimistic about the future, as he gradually takes over the reins, telling me he's launched a residency for artists and writers. He longs to see the Qila's salons and shaded courtyards filled with intellectuals, finding a muse in his beloved old home. Alongside this, Khan's elegant mother has an embroidery atelier, Qila Saz, which entirely benefits local women. Its gossamer fine chikan and glinting zardozi work, an inheritance of the great style of this region. The women are encouraged to open their own bank accounts and send their children to a reputable school. The family knows that the Qila means as much to those people as to them. This is not mere mortar, but a feeling, a belonging. So they continue loyally against all odds, and long may it last. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, where we delve further into the world of craftsmanship, I wish you all well.
You're listening to the Jaipur Rugs Podcast.
Hello, I'm Cosmo Brockway, and on the occasion of the 2024 edition of the Jaipur Lit Fest, you're listening to a specially commissioned podcast by Jaipur Rugs. In this edition, I'm reading from various passages from issues of The World of Interiors, the magazine where I'm a contributing editor based between Delhi and London. I first encountered La Martiniere College as a 19-year-old traveling through Uttar Pradesh, and its peeling facade and faded rooms immediately captured my attention. It was actually a decade before I had the opportunity to write about it, when I was commissioned by Rupert Thomas at World of Interiors, and I traveled there with photographer James McDonald. By then it had undergone a triumphant restoration. It was a very different story altogether, but no less captivating for it. Lyon and Lucknow may be several thousand miles apart, but they are linked by two things: a weaving heritage and one of history's great adventurers, Major General Claude Martin. Soldier, harem keeper, indigo farmer, palace builder, and hot air balloonist, Martin's life could perhaps only have taken place in the 18th century. A tropical Barry Lyndon, he was born in 1735 to generations of vinegar brewers, but thirsting for adventure, Martin fled Lyon with the Compagnie des Indes. His mother ordered him not to return until he was in a carriage, and he fought against the British in the Carnatic Wars prior to defecting to the East India Company once the French lost their colony at Pondicherry in 1761. Distrusted by both colonies as a deserter and not quite a gentleman, Martin nevertheless distinguishes himself as a strategist and surveyor with a Machiavellian turn of mind that thrived in the cut and thrust of the colonial derring do. Managing to get himself appointed to the plum role of superintendent of the arsenal for the Nawab of Awadh at Lucknow, Martin began to amass his fortune. Shadowy was the provenance of most of his riches, backdoor deals, Bhutanese battle loot, and bribes oiling the wheel of his rise, but Martin became the wealthiest farang in India. He also used his gift for design, probably influenced by the grand architecture of Lyon, to help transform Lucknow from a feudal backwater into a courtly masterpiece. Finding European trifles and trinkets for his decadent Nawab was another fertile source of rupees. Needing a mansion to match his newfound standing, the wily Frenchman built an elegant house on the banks of the Gomti River. He had the cellars designed to flood during hot weather, covered the ceilings with mirrors to reflect the ripples of the river, and christened it, somewhat ridiculously, Chateau de Lyon. Martin filled his mansion with Enlightenment-era treasures, including ranks of classical statues and a philosophical library with many Oriental manuscripts. In true potentate fashion, he installed 7 Indian mistresses and 2 African eunuchs, Makhboub and Amber, whom he had acquired from an Arab trader. Cloistered away in the chateau's outhouses, along with camels, elephants, priceless carpets, and English-made carriages, were artists painting botanical specimens and diamond cutters. As historian Rosie Llewellyn-Jones remarks in her book, The Estate of Major General Claude Martin, it was a mark of his wealth that he not only had diamonds, but men to cut them too. From silver tissue to gold-threaded brocade, to coarse chintz and country silk, Martin also amassed a vast textile collection, which he had fashioned into turbans, sashes, tents, hangings, and his pride and joy, a set of 4 Gobelin tapestries from Paris, depicting exotic panthers, lions, and horses. The extreme brilliancy of color was never again equaled in this country, according to a contemporary. The general took great care in building decent houses for his weavers and providing education for women. He invested in the local economy in the way few Europeans had ever bothered to do. In Calcutta, he owned and leased a riding school, the Menage, to Julius Sabiz, a free black man who had once been the lover of an English duchess. The Astronomer Royal in London, he would watch for potential attackers across the river and plains as he drank afternoon tea with his close friend and lingering house guest, the artist Johann Zoffany, whose checkered journey across India is a tale in its own right. It was against his colourful background that Martin conceived the idea of Constantia, the swan song of his old age, a fort-like palace that would be his legacy and final flourish, half a temple to himself, half a Freemason's lodge. Started in 1795, the building rose from its wooded setting, a spectacular sight, doubtless. It was snootily described by one contemporary as part Enlightenment mansion, part Nawabi fantasy, part colonial Gothic barracks, with all the loopholes and turrets of a medieval castle, while above, Palladian arcades rise up Mughal cupolas. No one could quite agree on its style, with some calling it Indo-French Baroque, and others a Persian palace or Italian ornate. As surreal and fanciful as its squire, Constantia's facade is dominated by a peculiar array of statues, including a pair of enormous lions, their mouths once lit with glowing red lanterns. No less ambitious is the interior, on which, with unbridled audacity, Martin lavished arabesque, bas-reliefs, and riotous stucco. It was rumored that he'd even imported plaster of Paris plaques from Josiah Wedgwood, although subsequent scholarship has concluded that they bear the mark of local craftsmen. Perhaps foreseeing his death, Martin made arrangements for his fantastical fort to be endowed as a boys' school named La Martinière College, along with 2 others in Calcutta and Lyon. He never actually saw the house completed, dying in 1800 and giving orders to be salted, put in spirits, or embalmed beneath his beloved Constantia. Sentimental perhaps, but also a final harumph to the Nawab, who he well knew would never take over a house with the desecrating presence of a kafir entombed below. Just over 2 centuries later, the ghostly and blackened edifice of La Martinière, its walls still pockmarked by the shelling from the 1857 War of Independence, looked in danger of keeling over like an aged elephant. Happily, the vision of conservation architect Dr. Nita Das, the dynamic campaigning of Principal Carlisle MacFarland, and the generosity of the school's alumni ignited an astonishing restoration, surely one of the most ambitious in modern India, transforming the peeling rooms and chapel into an exuberant tour de force of architectural redemption. The painting, joltingly jubilant and joyful in its tones, had been overseen by Ansar Ardeen, who has been restoring historic buildings in Lucknow for 2 decades. The artist was even awarded a medal by the French government for his masterly reinterpretation of Martin's 18th century gusto. Thanks to this disparate band of tireless champions, along with organizations such as Alliance Française in India, La Martinière once again stands gleaming. It remains a beacon of learning and belonging for generations of Martinians who flock to the annual Founders' Day from all around the world and proudly see themselves as sons of the Frenchman among the mangoes. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, where we delve further into the world of craftsmanship, I wish you all well.
You're listening to the Jaipur Rugs Podcast.
Hello, I'm Cosmo Brockway, and on the occasion of the 2024 edition of the Jaipur Lit Fest, you're listening to a specially commissioned podcast by Jaipur Rugs. In this edition, I'm reading from various passages from issues of The World of Interiors, the magazine where I'm a contributing editor based between Delhi and London. I remember I was standing in Portobello Road, rifling through silver teaspoons in a cardboard box, and an email pinged on my phone, and it was from Rupert Thomas, then editor-in-chief of World of Interiors, with one of his very engaging and charming emails that he really typed like a handwritten letter. And he said, Cosmo, I'd like you to go to Bologna and meet a rather extraordinary and eccentric lady who is a textile designer. And this was at the height of COVID. And the email read, rather than burrowing herself into lockdown, she's decided to move back to her hometown of Bologna and restore Rossini's Palazzo. And I think that you'd be the perfect person to write it. So, of course, undaunted, I accepted the commission and embarked on an extraordinary journey of a friendship with Iderica Gazzoni, who's the founder of the textile brand Argeman's World, based in Milan, that's inspired by the fictional travels of a Mughal princess. And this is a story I wrote about visiting her palazzo in Bologna with photographer James McDonald. Give me the laundress's bill, and I will set music even to that, wrote the great Italian opera composer Rossini. Though his prodigious output still inflames passions of Glyndebourne and La Scala, less well known are his talents for the decorative arts, the giddy vestiges of which can be seen in his old Bologna palazzo. Textile Iderica Gazzoni lives here today. Rossini found the imposing building overlooking Strada Maggiore at the height of his fame. Subsequently known as Casa Rossini, the palazzo in the city's noble quarter was procured by the composer in 1822 for the grand sum of 4,000 Roman scudi, the currency of the Papal States until 1866, through his friend Marchese Francesco Sampieri, who lived next door. The new owner set about its glorification. The two neighbors were a formidable duo. They held Sunday morning recitals that became the talk of cultured Europe and attracted performers such as Liszt and Paganini. Rossini's opera buffa, The Turk in Italy, took place in a theater erected especially at Sampieri's next door palazzo. A ghost of these quixotic days was discovered recently by Gazzoni as she descended the grand staircase one afternoon soon after moving in at the height of COVID lockdown. I had left music playing in the dining room and it naturally faded away as I walked through the rooms. Suddenly I came down the steps and it sprang up at me at perfect pitch and volume as though playing next to me. A marvel of genius that makes Rossini feel alive here still. More than just a clever conundrum of sound design, the sweeping staircase is but the first taste of the composer's exuberant style, and its trompe l'oeil theatre swags remain as vibrant as when they were first painted there in the early 19th century. Having commissioned painter and ornatist Francesco Santini, famed for his frescoes at the nearby cloister of the Celestines, to decorate his new palace, Rossini created euphoric murals of grotesques, classical figures and amorini, winged cherubs across the vaulted ceilings. When reconstructing the rooms between 1824 and 27, he moved his parents into the palazzo to oversee the work while he traveled. His father, Giuseppe, a musician who had been vilified for his fervent support of the French Revolution, stayed in situ until his death in 1839. Rossini spent more and more time in Paris, succumbing to its decadent charms, and finally sold the Palazzo, resolving never to own anything in Bologna again. Although his love affair with the city continued until his death, he wrote, "In Bologna I found hospitality and friendship. Bologna is my second homeland, and I'm proud to be her son, if not by birth, by adoption." Casa Rossini's second act came more recently, thanks in part to the dramatics of recent events. The Milan-based Gazzoni had tired of life in the city, and the unfolding of lockdown brought a renewed desire to live closer to her mother, Grazia, in the historic La Rossa, the affectionate local name for Bologna of her childhood. Perusing suitably lofty interiors online, the designer stumbled across this frescoed fantasy, whose atmosphere and scale reminded me so much of my mother's home, as she told me. Fortune was on her side, and Gazzoni moved into her new chapter. Undaunted by the vast bare walls and echoing enfilades, she set about conjuring the mise-en-scene with a resourcefulness that is her signature style. The stately, or in Gazzoni's word, absurd, dining room has been the most recent transformation. I had no pictures for the walls, and anyway, I wanted the vaulted frescoes to take the stage, so I hung Indian ikat printed silk all around the room, says the designer, laughing. To add to the strangeness, I placed Ginori plates from 1830 on chains over the fabric. It just works, she says with a flourish of her hands. It is typical of Gazzoni that my airily suggested addition of a palm or two to adorn the dining room resulted in a towering palm tree in an equally enormous terracotta pot appearing the next day. Some people are made for life on a startling scale, and she is one of them. Gazzoni's fervent travels through Rajasthan's Shekhavati district and Rajasthan have given her a longing to be surrounded by color. She has spent months cross-legged with rug artisans and textile weavers across Rajasthan and brought back bundles in her suitcases, which are now displayed giddily across the Palazzo's rooms. After mastering the smoke and mirrors of illusionist art as a muralist for two decades, Gazzoni set up the textile company Arjuman's World in 2009 after her seminal first visit to India, meaning that she got to travel the world to source fabric documents and antique pieces. She uses these as inspiration for the digitally printed creations seen at her seductive showroom on Milan's Via Santa Marta. I had a background in crafting fabrics with an Ottoman twist, so printing was a natural progression, says the designer, sitting in the long shadowed courtyard of her mother's palazzo. I have a fictional muse, a Mughal princess called Arjumand, for whom the Taj Mahal was built, and she voyages with me, inspiring me on her magic carpet. We source collections from 17th century Russian aristocrats, heavy centuries from merchants of the old Silk Road, and brocades from China's royal courts. In her piano nobly chambers at Casa Rossini, Gazzoni's swallow-like instinct has come to perch, for a season at least, or perhaps for life. The melding of ages, cultures, and artifacts is a boldly pitched coloratura, to use an opera term, which means elaborately ornamented vocals, featuring runs up and down the scale, trills, wide melodic leaps, and many fast notes. Relishing her newfound freedom from the correctness of Milanese life, the designer is her own conductor. She finds herself excited by the decorative dreams she is projecting onto this theatrical and moving spectacle of rooms. As she points out, an Anglo-Indian daybed from Chelsea's Guinevere, woven rugs from Jaipur, dream catchers by Bologna artist Giuseppe Brunetti, who's her son, and alluring designs from her own collections, it is clear that this is much more than a family home for Gazzoni. It is, as the Germans would say, a Luftschloss, a castle in the air, and rare are the people who actually bring them into being. Walking out into the shaded street to visit the nearby Gothic masterpiece of Basilica di Santa Marta de Servi, I ponder that the supposedly fictional Arjumand may be as real as the stones surrounding me. Such is the hypnotic power of Gazzoni's storytelling. In her palace of trompe l'oeil, my eye has been truly beguiled. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, where we delve further into the world of craftsmanship, I wish you all well.
You're listening to the Jaipur Rugs Podcast.
Hello, I'm Cosmo Brockway, and on the occasion of the 2024 edition of the Jaipur Lit Fest, you're listening to a specially commissioned podcast by Jaipur Rugs. In this edition, I'm reading from various passages from issues of The World of Interiors, the magazine where I'm a contributing editor based between Delhi and London. Dear Tone, scarlet sun loungers, awnings, parasols, and jazzy chevron stripes signal that you've arrived at Villa Palladio, a fantastical new hotel conjured up by three of the most accomplished alchemists in the game. When Barbara Miolini wrote to me and said that they were finished, that she and Marianne had finished this extraordinary and very seductive project outside of Jaipur, the first thing I did was write to you, Hamish Bowles, the then new editor of World of Interiors, and asked if we could cover it. It was an immediate yes in reply, and of course, as it should have been, it was the cover for the August Escape issue. And I'm so proud and honored to have had the exclusive story on the opening of what was the finest Indian hotel last year. Who among us on visiting Jaipur has not stood silent at our very first sight of Bar Palladio, surrounded by the peacock-strewn lawns of Narayan Nivan Palace, the pavilion with its Gothic-flavored windows, tented daybeds, and cool frescoes, might just be the most visually hypnotic restaurant in the world. The daydream turned triumph of Swiss-Italian Barbara Miolini, a longtime resident of the Pink City. It has already once spread its wings beyond the palace gates in the form of another whimsical set piece, the tangerine and mint-hued Cafe Palladio on a bougainvillea-lined road nearby. Now the triumvirate responsible, Miolini, Marianne Udujan, a Dutch designer and fellow expat, and Rajasthani painter Vikas Soni have struck again, this time alighting on a small palace nestled among the dromedary humps of the Aravalli Hills on the old camel road to Agra. What appears to be a former hunting lodge for a noble family, the pearl-white edifice is in fact only about 20 years old. Surrounded by neem and almond trees, it was ripe for the plucking. Barbara and Marianne's first heart-stopping tour of this sleeping beauty, where leopards might be found taking shade among the Chhatri domes, provided evidence of echoing empty rooms and pierced jali screens. It was in remarkably good state. We loved the simplicity. It felt like a villa in the Italian countryside somehow, says Marianne to me as we sit drinking Campari at dusk on the terrace. Of course, nothing is ever really that simple in India, and there are inevitably loops to jump through in addition to the pandemic, but it was destined to be given a new chapter as part of the Palladio family. While modern Jaipur has no dearth of debonair digs, Barbara and Marianne instantly knew that this palazzetto was perfect for the boutique hotel venture they'd been dreaming of. Set just a 20-minute drive outside the city, the journey flashing with tantalizing glimpses into turquoise-screened Haveli courtyards, Villa Palladio was a fantasy come to flesh. Barbara, who relishes the respite it offers from the Jaipur noise, told me that the creation, despite the obvious stress of starting any project, has been such a pleasure. Each day I find myself in the fresh air, amid village living and a simple way of life. Curled up like a cat on the veranda steps, Marianne explains the initial vision for this modern-day interpretation of a desert caravanserai. I had an idea of mingling the exuberance and decadence of the Maharajas with a heady dose of Italian flair, she said. Her eyes fixed on the horizon beyond the castellated walls, she adds, the countryside has given me countless moments of visual inspiration. The women in the fields, the durries hanging on the walls of the village houses, scarlet, yellow, aquamarine figures, the Rajput princesses celebrating in their finery, the intricacy of the rugs in the city palace. The kaleidoscope of influences from her meanderings across Rajasthan has been shaken down and poured out of the designer's imagination as a brilliant, pulsating red. The villa is the reddest and pinkest apparition I've ever seen. What a shame that Diana Vreeland is no longer with us to arrive on a caparisoned elephant and then sweep into the galleried hall, a symphony of her favorite color. Red, she held forth, is the great clarifier. Bright, cleansing, and revealing, it makes all colors beautiful. It is certainly a typically self-assured choice from the duo. This is about how pattern and color work together to create a mood, Barbara explains to me. The red was actually inspired by cardinals' robes and our memories of Rome. No doubt the arching rooms will shimmer by night as the jeunesse dorée flock. Villa Palladio is about play and delight, she adds. And when it comes to colour, Marianne really is brilliant. She just feels it, lives it, like no one else I've ever met. Everywhere are touches of levity and wit, from the red, white and black checkerboard marble floors up. The vast heights of the central hall salon have been bedecked with jaunty made-up crests of bears and roosters, while palm trees entwine with scarlet fronds snaking up the walls. I'm enchanted to catch sight of a huddle of artisans applying Orientalist gold roof to canopied daybeds. Perhaps only Marianne could apply instant chinoiserie in the middle of the desert. Scarlet striped corridors lit by red and black sconces suggest My Fair Lady, but with a surreal twist. In all, 9 bedrooms trumpet with varying shades of red. One twin room sports pagoda shade bed canopies against walls painted with splendid palm trees and vibrant red trellises. Another chamber beckons with a scalloped four-poster bed flanked by stained glass arches. A vaulting kitchen, strangely reminiscent of an English country house, was designed by talented ceramicist Simon Marks, alongside a fragrant herbarium brimming with fruits of the soil. We wanted there to be a strong element of privacy and peace, Barbara says, as we stroll through the scented trees. So we constructed the ramparts to enclose the space and make it feel more intimate, a secret garden. There is something conspiratorial and playful here. It is meant to evoke a sense of childlike fantasy. The Alice in Wonderland air continues beyond a tall hedge where there is a chevron-striped schoolhouse, its awning reflected in the glistening water below. Concealed by raw palms and hibiscus, it is a nod, according to Barbara, to European formal gardens with their fanciful follies. At that precise moment, we spy one of the staff, devilishly slim-hipped in a pair of floral trousers, holding a bunch of lilies. One by one, the Rajput men, all bridal innocence and curling moustaches, line up to snap each other, clasping the bouquet. It provides a lasting image as I prepare to set on my way, along with the colour, of course. Here, Barbara has the final word. When travellers leave us here in the Pink City, she says, I would like them to remember the red. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, where we delve further into the world of craftsmanship, I wish you all well.
You're listening to the Jaipur Rugs Podcast.
Hello, I'm Cosmo Brockway, and on the occasion of the 2024 edition of the Jaipur Lit Fest, you're listening to a specially commissioned podcast by Jaipur Rugs. In this edition, I'm reading from various passages from issues of The World of Interiors, the magazine where I'm a contributing editor based between Delhi and London. As a method of transport, carpets appear most often in Middle Eastern folktales, with a notable example being 1001 Nights. In one of the stories, Prince Hussein acquires a magic carpet in the Indian city of Bisnagar, which teleports its user rather than makes him fly. However, enchanted rugs have in fact appeared in the legends and myths of numerous nations and not always as fables. King Solomon, him of the Old Testament, was famous not only for his wisdom, but also, in Jewish mythology, a glorious large flying carpet. Made of green silk with golden weft, the carpet was 60 miles long and just as wide. The Jewish sage, Ben Shirira, gave 2 different versions on how the king got his hands on such a magnificent treasure. The first account claims that the Queen of Sheba gave Solomon his flying carpet as proof of her undying love. However, the king was more interested in the construction of the Temple of Jerusalem, and the queen's gift went to one of his many courtiers. When news about it reached the redoubtable queen, she was so furious she refused to have anything more to do with flying carpets. Thus, the legend says, the knowledge on how to create them was lost. Another version says that the carpet was a gift from God himself. With such a splendid gift, Solomon's pride grew to unbearable heights, and God decided to punish him. When the carpet was mid-air, it shook, and as a result, the 40,000 men seated on it plummeted to their deaths. In the 2nd century BC, a king of Parthia named Phraates II was said to be at war with Antiochus, the ruler of the Seleucid Empire. According to the legend, Fratos flew from the Zagros Mountains on the carpet and heroically defeated his enemy. Another example from the 3rd century AD says that the Roman Emperor Valerian was abducted during a surprise attack of the Sasanian ruler, who effortlessly found his way into the camp on his flying carpet. Persian parchments have been found which claim that a certain soil had magnetic properties which enabled rugs to fly. The scribe Ben Shariria claims that the legendary library of Alexandria, founded by the pharaoh Ptolemy I, had an abundance of magic carpets in stock. One could be curious about their purpose, but what needs to be remembered is that this library contained all the knowledge of the ancient world, thousands of scrolls, some of which were written in languages considered ancient even in those times. Sadly, all of this precious knowledge was lost in a fire that destroyed the building itself, as well as these magic carpets. The historical sources vary on who to blame for this, naming Julius Caesar and various pashas as potential culprits. However, the true destruction of flying carpets can be blamed on Genghis Khan. According again to the Jewish scribe, the Mongolian army massacred the last artisans who wove flying rugs and stole the very last of them. When a prisoner dared to boast to Genghis Khan that these carpets were more agile than his famed steppe ponies, the angered Khan decapitated him and ordered the burning of all looted carpets, thus ending the magic story of these. The flying carpet also appears in Russian folk tales. In one of them, Baba Yaga, an old witch, gives one to Ivan the Fool, among other magical trinkets, to help the folk hero in his quest. Long may this transportation of the imagination stay in our culture and adorn our homes. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, where we delve further into the world of craftsmanship, I wish you all well.
You're listening to the Jaipur Rugs Podcast.
Hello, I'm Cosmo Brockway, and on the occasion of the 2024 edition of the Jaipur Lit Fest, you're listening to a specially commissioned podcast by Jaipur Rugs. In this edition, I'm reading from various passages from issues of The World of Interiors, the magazine where I'm a contributing editor based between Delhi and London. I don't think there's any greater titan of creativity in modern scene here in India as Jean-Francois Lesage, and it was a long-held dream of mine to write about his house outside Pondicherry. And in researching the story, I got the commission and I was tasked with ringing the man himself to ask permission. Now, of course, the immediate response was a very Gallic no. And I remember exactly the scene. I was standing in Robert Keim in London, pacing up and down the floor, talking to him, his coastal idyll. And it took me 25 minutes, and by the end of the 25 minutes on the telephone, I'd got him to agree. And it's still a moment of great pride that I did achieve that. And here is a little bit of what I wrote. The Napoleonic bee of Imperial France has made an unlikely entry into South India through the work of noted designer Jean-Francois Lesage. The Paris native had his first taste of Eastern life, aged 19, during a visit to the frontier city of Peshawar, an experience he describes, somewhat cryptically, as drowning in a vat of sensual honey. A subsequent trip to Varanasi led to a seminal moment in his life. Walking along, the young Lesage found himself in the entire district plunged into darkness. The only bulb lit was in an embroidery workshop, where a carrier was bent over his wooden frame with his needle. The years passed by, but Lesage could not ignore his vocation and call to India. Chennai has been the designer's base for the last two decades. Lesage established an atelier here with partner Patrick Savoret in a grand colonial bungalow, employing 200 artisans to create embroidery celebrated the world over. His work has included interiors at Chateau de la Veuve de Vicomte near Paris, Monaco's L'Opéra de Monte Carlo, and the restoration of one of Napoleon's thrones. A chance drive and glimpse of a ruined building led to Lesage purchasing a 19th century manor house in a quiet village between Pondicherry and Chennai. The designer wanted a remote location and a high wall. He determinedly pursued all 16 of the family branches co-owning the property to sign the sales form in an impressive 2 years. He recalls the obstacles to overcome over whiskey. There was a buffalo skull in the central courtyard, which was said to be a curse, so we had to get the pundits to come and do never-ending pujas, he laughs. The house's structure had trees growing through it, but the ambitiousness of the project only spurred this pragmatic Frenchman on towards its current incarnation. Built by a prominent salt merchant, the Anglo-Indian house, surrounded by rare acacia, neem, coconut and palm trees, is divided into two parts. The front facade is an imposing two-story master's house, and the rear a single-story courtyard with teak columns and a faded tile and thatch roof. Lesage erected a further striking boundary wall and gates to shelter the property, which has given rise to amusing local tales of an eccentric Varangi Raja with a fabled menagerie. The menagerie holds true. Several glossy Weimaraners stalk the house, and the grounds sport ornamental guinea fowl, peacocks, and all manner of exotic birds housed in pagoda-shaped residences. There is a secret pavilion swimming pool among the trees, a herd of pre-Hindu terracotta animal carvings guarding a lily pond, and a thatched cottage onne for guests. Nothing is allowed to be simply utilitarian. The scene conjures an 18th century toile created by Huguenot weavers dreaming of La Vie de l'Orient. Pandadu interiors are no less beguiling. Two drawing rooms on the ground and first floors feature ebony furniture, portraits of South Indian Rajas, bowls of 1920s faux fruit, and a woven tiger skin atop an extraordinary Persian silk rug. One bedroom features a high rosewood four-poster bed and atmospheric family portraits inherited from France. The morning light filters in through the shutters and settles on the delicate familial rose antique bowl. The rooms might have been untouched for a century. Richly coloured and gold-threaded deities line the walls and climax in a shrine behind the dining room. Breakfast is taken on the eye-catching terrace, each plant and shrub known and loved, with Lesage perhaps the most exotic bloom of all, pristine in the humid heat in a white handspun kurta, a man at home. Pandadu led Lesage's friend Christian Louboutin to write to me. There is an expression in French which is la vie rêvée. It means the dream life. The most obvious illustration of this is the dreamy world that Jean-Francois has managed to create with his house in South India. I don't want his life, I'm pretty happy with mine, but I want his world. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time where we delve further into the world of craftsmanship, I wish you all well.
You were listening to the Jaipur Rugs podcast.